This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
I regard myself as a soldier, though a soldier of peace.
The natural power of the universe is harnessed in the new atomic bomb.
Terrorize people about a bomb attack while they're completely diverted and weakened in their effort to wipe out dangerous radicals right here at home.
Now, wait a minute, Minerva.
Firstly, there isn't going to be a war, and secondly, war doesn't stop progress. It stimulates progress.
Yes, war can be a highly stimulating thing.
Oh, well, after all, I'll be exaggerating the horrors of war. Don't we rather overdo that song? After all, you know, the last war wasn't as bad as some people make out. We didn't worry. Something great seemed to have got hold of us.
Something greater still may get hold of us next time. If we don't end war, war will end us.
Well, what can you do?
Yeah. What can we do?
I still have a dream that somehow this situation can and will be changed.
This is my idle daydream, a world at peace with nobody soldiers in other people's lands. That vision seldom makes the newspapers, the television, or the violent movies and computer games. Who could talk about real peace? My mind goes immediately to Bruce Gagnon. He's the coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. Bruce has a blog, a world campaign, a public access television show in Maine, appearances in alternative video. He speaks, and he writes, and he protests, and Bruce has a lifelong commitment to the unsung underdogs of another America, the dream of disarmament and peace. Bruce, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
It sounds like such a simpleton's dream, Bruce. Peace as a gift to our kids, to our world. Is it stupid to even talk about this stuff?
Well, it's funny that right now the businesses of America are trying to sell us on the coming Christmas holiday, the time where the Prince of Peace was born, and millions of people, millions and millions, hundreds of millions of people around the world will go to church and pray and remember the Prince of Peace. So I don't think we're alone in that vision. The problem, I think, is that a lot of people that pray and talk about the Prince of Peace then don't make the connections and don't make the links to what our government is doing today around the world, the war machine that it has become, and how that expenditure of about $1 trillion a year on militarism, $8 billion every month for the war in Afghanistan, how that spending is actually contributing in a major way to our economic collapse at home. So I think the way we're going to have peace in the world, what the Prince of Peace wanted us to have, where we would love our enemies and turn the other cheek and forgive those who've trespassed against us, the only way we're going to have that in the real world is when we begin to dismantle this war machine, this empire that the U.S. has today.
Even in my own mind, I'm not sure a less armed world is possible. It's hard to think outside the box when you've grown up with something that's always been that way. Let me raise some obvious objections to American withdrawal, the ones that you must hear all the time, against closing U.S. bases around the world or resigning as a self-appointed cop of global affairs. So here's the first one. Would rogue states and dictatorships rise up that would be worse than the Americans, possibly arming themselves with long-range nuclear missiles? I mean, there are plenty of bullies and weak social structures facing insurmountable problems in some countries already. Would the move to peace create worse monsters than we have now?
Well, I think we have to be honest with ourselves and recognize that the number one industrial export product of America today is what?
Well,
it's weapons.
Yeah.
And when weapons are your number one industrial export product, what is your global marketing strategy for that product line?
It's got to be war.
That's right. The more war you have, the more instability, the more weapons you sell, the more contracts you have. You might remember that just last month, Obama went to India with a $15 billion weapons sales to India, who has 450 million people living in poverty. Now, they can't really afford to join the arms race, but we're dragging them into it because it's good for American business. So the truth of the matter is, I believe, that one reason we have so much instability around the world today is because the United States helps create it. When I was in the Air Force during the Vietnam War, I worked in personnel, and I remember looking at the records of the officers assigned to U.S. embassies all across the Asian Pacific region. And in every single case, their job description was the same: act as liaison between the host government and U.S. weapons corporations. Basically, they were salesmen for U.S. weapons corporations, selling weapons to the host government in Pakistan and Afghanistan, all over the world. And so these are the countries now where we see the most instability today, the ones that the U.S. has armed over the years. In many cases, in most cases, it's also related to our desire to extract declining resources like oil and water and natural gas and other things like that. So there can be peace, to answer your question in a very long-winded way. There can be peace if we end our addiction to militarism, to endless war, and our demand for control of the world's resources. We have to become a good neighbor in the world, and I think when we do that, all of these things are possible.
I suppose that relates to the energy situation. If we could have self-sufficient energy, if we had solar and wind generated right on American soil, then we wouldn't have to have bases in the Middle East and go try and grab Iraq's oil or somebody else's oil.
That's exactly right. And think about it for a second. As I said earlier, our number one industrial export product today is weapons. But what if we converted those military production plants across the United States? Virtually every state has them now, as the Congress and the military-industrial complex have spread the gravy out across the country. What if the citizens were to demand the conversion of these facilities? For example, where I live in Bath, Maine, they build the Aegis destroyer that is being outfitted with missile defense systems and that are being parked just off the coast of China today. What if instead of building those, a very provocative system that is forcing China to respond militarily, what if we were building wind turbines or rail systems to help us get out of our gas-guzzling cars so we don't need as much oil, and it, in a small way, helps solve for climate change as well? And most interestingly of all, creates more jobs. The University of Massachusetts at Amherst Economics Department did a study just a couple years ago where they looked at $1 billion, and they said, yes, it's true. If you spend $1 billion on military production, you create 8,555 jobs. But they said you take that same $1 billion and you put it into home weatherization, you create more than 13,000 jobs. You put it into building rail systems and you create 19,000 jobs per $1 billion. So which would we rather have? 8,500 jobs building weapons for endless war, or 19,000 jobs building rail systems, something we need to end our addiction to oil, to help solve for climate change? The answer is simple, but the problem is the American people don't know about it. At the very time where they're clamoring for jobs, demanding more jobs, we could be creating more jobs if we converted the military-industrial complex.
Well, you raised China, and that was my next possible objection. Won't they simply dominate the world without U.S. bases all over the place?
China's got a lot of poor people they have to feed and they have to take care of. And the CIA reported just a few years ago that China's first priority was dealing with their poor people, trying to take care of them, create a better way of life. China's leading the world in developing new green technologies now as they're expanding their economy. So, in fact, there is competition between the United States and China for oil. There's no doubt about it. China imports 80% of its oil on ships. And, in fact, that's one of the reasons why the U.S. is doubling its military presence in the Asian Pacific region so that it can develop the military strategy to be able to choke off China's importation of oil. So there is a lot of conflict over oil. But again, if we move away from our addiction to oil, if we move away from the need for oil and begin to develop the technologies that lessen our dependence on oil, everything changes. Now, Obama, when he ran for president, said he was going to do this, but he hasn't. In fact, he's not put the money into it that he said he was going to, into developing these green technologies, and he's expanded the military at the same time. He's expanded the U.S. operations in the Asian Pacific region in order to surround China. So he's betrayed his words. So the people must really engage here. They must re-escalate our demands on Congress. We've got to educate the public about how we could be getting more jobs from our tax dollars if we moved away from militarism and empire.
The last time that the U.S. choked off the oil to an Asian country, it was Japan in the late 1930s, and we saw how that went. We ended up with World War II. But I have to say, the whole idea of the China demon just doesn't sit well with history, because with the exception of Tibet, which is a bad case, China just doesn't have a history of going out and invading other people's countries. They build up their own country, and those who want to go abroad in a business way and develop trade. And they haven't spent, they haven't created the thousands and tens of thousands of nuclear weapons that both Russia and the United States did. So I'm not buying the China demon as a reason why we can't disarm.
Well, you're exactly right. And you know, let's just look at the numbers. The U.S., according to the late Chalmers Johnson, the former CIA agent who sadly just died in the last week or two, he has estimated for years that the U.S. has more than 800 bases around the world. Well, how many does China have? I don't think they have really any outside of their country that I'm aware of, military bases. So, you know, let's be, you know, frank about all of this. I think your comment is absolutely appropriate.
Well, what happens to the defense of Germany and Japan if Americans close their bases and go home?
Who's going to attack them? Russia isn't going to attack them. In fact, it's the opposite today. You know, when the Berlin Wall came down, the U.S. promised Russia, at that time the former Soviet Union, Mikhail Gorbachev, the U.S. promised them that we would not expand NATO eastward into the former Soviet bloc 1 centimeter. Well, Clinton broke that promise and began the expansion of NATO. Bush followed it, and now Obama's continuing it. We're militarily surrounding Russia today, moving U.S. bases into Bulgaria and Romania, into Poland, now moving missile defense systems into many, and NATO bases, by the way, into many countries bordering Russia. And at the same time, the U.S., Obama now, has announced the deployment of these, again, these Aegis destroyers outfitted with these so-called missile defense systems into the Baltic Sea. Well, this is outrageous. If we had tried to do all these kind of things during the Cold War, we would have gone to nuclear war over it. If the reverse was happening today, if Russia was trying to put bases in Mexico and Canada and putting its ships right on the coast of the Atlantic and Pacific coast of the U.S., we'd be freaking out in this country. But we're doing it, and the American people don't even know about it.
Radio EcoShock.
We're going through a series of possible objections, well, to peace, with Bruce Gagnon, who's a main activist, and we're going to get to his website and his activism in just a minute. But, Bruce, another thing, you bring up the nuclear weapons. If America were to take back its bases and come home, bring the troops home, maybe their only defense then, our only defense, would be to have these nuclear weapons, and it might make a nuclear exchange even more likely with devastating cities. What about that argument?
Well, it's nonsense. We have more nuclear weapons than anybody else in the world. Let's just take China. China today has 20 nuclear missiles capable of hitting the west coast of the U.S. 20. And in fact, this is why they're so agitated by the U.S. deployment of these missile defense systems on these Aegis destroyer ships, U.S. naval ships up against their coast, but also putting ground-based so-called missile defense systems into Taiwan, just off the coast of mainland China, into Japan, into South Korea, throughout the region. And so the job of these missile defense systems is only one thing. It's part of U.S. first strike technology. U.S. hits China first, and then when China tries to fire some of their 20 nuclear missiles in retaliation that might survive a U.S. first strike attack, missile defense systems' job is to pick them off for a successful U.S. first strike. And in fact, the U.S. Space Command has been wargaming such an attack on China, set in the year 2016, for many years now. So it's not just theoretical. They're, in fact, wargaming this very thing. And China sees this U.S. military encirclement of them today, understanding that, again, they import 80% of their oil on ships just off their coast, where the U.S. is creating this military expansion. They're getting a little nervous about the whole thing, and they're saying, we're going to have to respond. We're going to have to increase our military as a result, and that's begun to happen. And the U.S. then cries like any bully does and says, oh, look, 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 when the bully beats up the little pipsqueak in the neighborhood, and finally the pipsqueak stands up and says, stop it, and the bully then cries foul. Well, that's exactly what the U.S. is saying today. Wow, look at China. My God, they're building up. We need even more. And so the senators from my state, the two Republican senators, Susan Collins and Olympia Snow, so-called moderates, are now saying we need a bigger Navy because look what China is doing after we push them around, kick sand in their face year after year.
Oh, my. This makes me pretty sad, I got to tell you.
Well, you know, it's the reality of our moment here in America, and many American people don't want to hear it. They don't want to think about it. But at the same time, they say they want change. They say they want, American people say they want jobs. They say they want a better economy. Well, you can't, as the old song goes, you can't have one without the other.
Let's get back to home. What about the impacts on employment? Joining the armed forces has been a traditional safety valve for the poor to find a job. U.S. unemployment is already near record highs. Wouldn't the country implode with the release of hundreds of thousands of soldiers coming home?
Well, only if they had something to come home to, and right now they don't. We all know the story. The big corporations have decided they don't need us in America anymore. They're moving overseas so that they can maximize profits internationally, moving to China or India or other Asian countries where workers in Vietnam, they're working even cheaper than they're working in China today, I recently read. So they don't really have jobs for us in America anymore. And in fact, the Pentagon has been saying for some time that under corporate globalization of the world economy, this is the way it's going to go. The corporations will move jobs overseas, maximize profits, and America's role, they say every different country will have a role under corporate globalization. China or India will make things, for example. U.S.'s role, they say, will be security export. And so that's, again, what we're doing today. We're making weapons. We're militarizing our culture. And we're moving into endless war for control of declining resources. So they say that will be our role under corporate globalization. And so you could bring the troops home, but bring them home to what? Unless you, and here's the key, you convert the military-industrial complex. The government has to take a role in converting the military-industrial complex to building a solar society. Imagine, for example, if we put a solar device on virtually every house and business in America. Solar works even here in Maine, where I live, and today we have snow on the ground. Mm. Imagine the jobs created in manufacturing and installation, repair.
A lot of workshops going up across America, and that's what it used to look like.
Imagine the jobs created if we build a rail system connecting every corner of this country. The old-timers here in Maine talk about the years past when rail connected every corner of the state of Maine. But now people can't really afford to drive in this very big state, geographically, small population, but a very big state, and people can't hardly afford to drive from one end to the other anymore. It's getting so that we're losing our ability to travel in this state. What if we had a rail system? What if we were building that rather than weapons? Then you'd have jobs to bring the troops home to. But again, it only is going to happen if we demand it. And right now, you hear that both the Republicans and Democrats saying we got to get big government out of doing things. Well, that's just the wrong response at this time. We need, see, the conservatives love big government. They love big military government. They love big government that gives tax breaks to the rich. They love big government that bails out the Wall Street bankers and hedge funds when they get in trouble. But they don't like big government when it works for the people, when it works for the poor, when it works for the environment. Then they don't like big government, and that's when they trash it. So we have to be a little more sophisticated in terms of what we really hear and how we interpret what we hear coming out of the mainstream media.
For those just tuning in, this is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. I'm here with Maine peace activist Bruce Gagnon. We are taking the time to dream about peace, for our children's future, where weapons of mass destruction and fear are the ghosts of a long-gone past. Bruce, for those who want to find out more about what you're talking about, can you give us one of your websites?
Yeah, right. The organization that I work for is called the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. And the website is spaceforpeace.org, spaceforpeace.org. And also I do a blog almost really every day, kind of my organizing life blog, you know, of what I do from day to day as an organizer and key issues that I think that people should know about. It's called Organizing Notes, and you can find it from our website at spaceforpeace.org, or you can just Google Organizing Notes, add my name to it, Bruce Gagnon, should come right up, and you could take a look at that.
And I'd point out to listeners that the Space 4 piece, that's with the number 4 in it there.
Either way, actually.
Oh, it works either way.
We've got that, and we've also got spaceforpeace.com, so we've tried to get all the, just get close to, you know, close to it, and you should be able to find it.
All righty. Well, Bruce, what about peace and climate change? You touched on it a little bit earlier. The U.S. military is the single largest consumer and burner of oil products in the world, with all those emissions damaging the atmosphere. Just think of all the planes and the boats and the equipment that just runs on, and none of it's energy efficient, I can tell you that. How can there be a climate campaign that is not also a peace campaign?
That's a great question, Alex. You know, it's always puzzled me why the environmental community hasn't really said a peep about the fact, as you just said, that the military is the biggest polluter in the world. Our wars around the world are causing havoc environmentally to the planet. So why don't environmental groups ever talk about the military? And I think it's because, sadly, they've become generally captives of the Democratic Party. And the Democrats like to get in their canoes on Earth Day and get their pictures taken for the local paper, and local environmental activists like to say, well, we have access to the Democrats and we don't want to lose that. If we're critical of the U.S. war machine, then we'll lose our support amongst the Democrats. But in the sort of, I hate to quote Sarah Palin, but let me do it. How is that relationship with the Democrats working for you these days when it comes to climate change, when it comes to really promoting sustainable technology development in America? What are the Democrats doing for the environmental movement? And I think it's kind of like the way the Republicans use the abortion issue, you know, to pull in that constituency, but in a lot of ways, you know, kind of abuse them. They haven't really delivered to them the way they would like, and I'm glad, frankly, but I think you get the point. We have to be careful in our movement building that we don't become captives of any political party. And what has happened in this country, I think, far, far too much, is that the progressive community has become literal slaves to the Democratic Party, to the point where, as we're now seeing with Obama, he is betraying the progressive constituency on virtually every issue, whether it's taxes for the rich, whether it's torture in Guantanamo, whether it's expanding the war in Afghanistan, continuing the war in Iraq with our bases there, continuing the military buildup. You go down the list of any issue, gay rights issues, you know, it's just everything. The unions, he's betrayed them on the legislation to help make it easier for unions to organize. I mean, just virtually every issue that the Obama and the Democratic Party has betrayed the constituency. But so many people are still slavishly standing there, you know, and not willing to stand up and, you know, tell the truth about what's going on. And as long as we surrender our movements to a political party, then we're not going anywhere. We're not going to really accomplish anything. So we have to be a lot more independent. This doesn't mean you can't vote for Democrats or anything like that anymore. It just means that you don't surrender your movement. Movement comes first, and political party loyalty comes second. We have to, again, be honest with ourselves that these parties are under the control of the corporate money today. You can't really run for office anymore unless you're a multimillionaire. I mean, it's just absolutely ridiculous. So why do we so slavishly give ourselves over to these parties that are corporate manifestations?
Well, and another aspect of it, too, is that when we propose building these giant wind farms and solar farms and things that could really help us, the transportation systems, well, we just don't have the money. We can't afford it anymore. We're already having troubles with our school budgets. So, but we could do it if we could convert this whole military spending. What is it, about half of all available dollars go to the Pentagon and the military-industrial complex? We could do a lot with that money if it was brought back home.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, right now, the latest number is 54 cents out of every federal tax dollar, discretionary tax dollar, is spent, controlled by the military. And I was in a meeting this Saturday where someone said, who I have full confidence in, said that number is soon to rise to 57 cents. I can't verify that myself, but I did hear that, and I'll be checking that out as soon as I can.
So where is the tipping point when Americans at home realize they're losing essential social services like fire and police? The schools aren't adequate in so many areas. The only developed country not to have universal health care, because half of all that money goes to military and overseas apparatus of control and empire that really isn't benefiting them. Where is the tipping point where people say, no, we want that money back, and we want to spend it here in America on services that we need?
Well, what you describe basically is the disintegration of social progress in America. And it's not only happening here. We've seen it recently with the protests in Greece and Ireland and Italy, all over Europe, around the world. This is all part of corporate globalization. I think, essentially, that corporate globalization is really a return to feudalism, except this time corporate feudalism. You get a color TV, you get a car, you get a credit card where you're basically an indentured servant to the corporations for the rest of your life, paying off your debt. But it's still feudalism because it's a drowning of democracy. It's putting the corporations, you know, they talk about global government. Well, they've created a corporate global government. Corporations control government everywhere. In our network, we're an international network of peace activists working on the space issue. I talk to friends all the time around the world, and they all say the same thing. Corporate consolidation of the media, corporate takeover of the politicians and their governments at virtually every level, local, state, federal. So this is happening worldwide. It's not just here in America. And so we need a global movement that speaks out against this corporate domination of everything, of resources, of media, of government, of democracy. And we need to begin to become more sophisticated in our organizing. We have to organize both locally, nationally, and internationally. And we have to have a unified demand worldwide, and that is to convert the global war machine, because it's killing us all, it's polluting the planet, and it's stealing from all of us in terms of social progress. So that's the answer. Now, of course, it's difficult. Of course, it's not easy, but that's where we start. And for me, it's a certain sense of liberation. Now that I know and completely understand the problem, completely see the picture, now I can deal with it. Now I can talk about it. Now I can organize around it. And that's what we're trying to do.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Bruce Gagnon, the longtime Maine peace activist now fighting against the militarization of space. Read his blog at spaceforpeace.blogspot.com. Now, Bruce, does America even have a plan B? Have you seen credible reports on how to demilitarize without collapsing the nation?
No, they have no plan. In fact, they're going the other direction. They're expanding. Every plan, every indication is that they're going to continue to expand militarism. They're going to make some showcase cuts because they know they have to, because there is a growing demand. I don't want to be all negative. The American people are beginning to see the picture. Recent polls are showing that 60-some percent of the American people think that Afghanistan is a disaster, and they understand that their money is being wasted, $8 billion a month in Afghanistan. So the American people are beginning to figure it out. They just feel disempowered. They just don't have any confidence. They don't have any belief that anything can be done. And that's where we as organizers have a big job ahead of us. We've got to help move people through the steps into action so that we can begin to change things. If we don't, we're going down for sure. There's no guarantee we're going to be successful, but we definitely know that if we just sit on our ass and don't do anything, and give way to cynicism, give way to I don't call it apathy because I don't think the people are apathetic. I think they just feel beaten down. And so we can't give in to that. We have to, what I like to say, rattle our chains. Get up, rattle our chains. And when we do that together, because we got to remember, we're not doing this by ourselves now. It's happening all over the world. I just put a student protest all over Italy on my blog just the other day. Students in all the major cities in Italy were protesting against cuts in education. I mean, they're on it. They're out there. They're organizing. They're fighting back. But we're not doing it in this country. We need to get with the rest of the world and get on the case and get moving.
But, Bruce, I've got so much student debt. If I get an arrest, I'll never get a job, and I'll never pay this debt off. So I really I appreciate your efforts for peace, but I can't do anything myself right now.
Well, that is well said, Alex, because that's a huge problem, and I think you're right. But the other thing is when you say that, you're acknowledging that you're a slave. You are literally acknowledging that you are an indentured servant, that you are even more than that, that you are a slave to the corporations. In fact, sometimes you're even wearing their T-shirt, Coca-Cola, Pepsi, Pizza Hut. You're even advertising for them for free. I mean, you've got to stop this. You've got to end this mental colonization that has occupied, you know, your mind. You have to decolonize your mind, decolonize your personhood, and become a human being again. That's how basic this thing is right now. And that's where each of us has a responsibility to start with ourselves, decolonize our own minds, recognize how these corporations have taken full control of our minds, our bodies, and our future. And we can't let it happen, not if we're going to be human beings.
So well said, Bruce Gagnon. I'm going to take a second out here, Bruce, just to quote from a recent article in Tom's Dispatch, the blog. It's called Taking Down America by Alfred W. McCoy. He's a professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. The article suggests four scenarios, ways that America might handle its declining role in the world. In one, by 2020, a desperate America faces off with rising China or even India in space warfare. To check China and extend its military position globally, Washington is intent on building a new digital network of air and space robotics, advanced cyber warfare capabilities, and electronic surveillance. Military planners expect this integrated system to envelop the Earth in a cyber grid capable of blinding entire armies on the battlefield or taking out a single terrorist in field or favela. By 2020, if all goes according to plan, the Pentagon will launch a three-tiered shield of space drones, reaching from stratosphere to exosphere, armed with agile missiles, linked by a resilient modular satellite system, and operated through total telescopic surveillance. Last April, the Pentagon made history. It extended drone operations into the exosphere by quietly launching the X-37B unmanned space shuttle into a low orbit 255 miles above the planet. The X-37B is the first in a new generation of unmanned vehicles that will mark the full weaponization of space, creating an arena for future warfare unlike anything that has gone before. That was a quote from Alfred W. McCoy, a professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He has convened a group of 140 historians to examine the fall of past empires in the hopes of finding a soft landing, not just for the United States, but I guess for all the client military states, which includes Greater Europe, for example. Bruce Gagnon, the subject of space weapons is one of your specialties. Is a coming space war likely, and what could we do to stop it?
Well, they already are fighting war through space, if you think about it. When the U.S. launched the shock and awe invasion of Iraq in 2003, in the initial attack, 70% of the weapons that were used were directed to their targets by space satellites, by space technology. So those military satellites in space today essentially serve a role as a weapon, because they're directing war. The Pentagon says today all war on the Earth is net-centric. In other words, it's coordinated by military space technology. Now, the U.S. says if we could do that, so could somebody else. So could Russia or China or even the European Union. And so we can't allow anyone else to have that capability, so we must have weapons to destroy other countries' satellites, what they call anti-satellite weapons, ASATs. so that we will be the master of space. And in the Space Command planning documents over the years, beginning first with Vision for 2020 and other ones since, they've spelled out that we, the U.S., must control space, dominate space, and deny other countries access to space. And so those are the things that are now under development. Anti-satellite weapons, a whole host of different varieties are under development. Out in Albuquerque, New Mexico, the Air Force is working on firing a laser from the ground that goes up into space and would destroy a satellite. They're working on things that would fly up into space and smash into other countries' satellites. They're working on satellites that would go and hit other satellites. So that on many different levels, your tax dollars are being wasted on creating the infrastructure for an arms race in space. And Russia and China and even the European Union today are saying, we can't let the U.S. control space by itself. We're going to have to get in this game, too, and we're off to a new arms race. Because clearly, whoever controls space is going to control the world below, and everybody knows it. And so that's the danger we're in today. And that's why the work of our global network against weapons and nuclear power in space is so important, because we've got to stop this new arms race from happening. And the Pentagon says Star Wars will be the largest industrial project in the history of the planet Earth. So how in the hell are we going to afford to pay for that? Well, they have a plan. Some years ago, in the industry publication that I subscribe to called Space News, they had an editorial, and they said, we've got to be responsible corporate citizens. We've got to send our lobbyists to Washington and secure a funding source for these space projects we want. And we're doing that, the editorial said. We're going after the entitlement programs, which today officially are Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and what's left of the welfare program after Bill Clinton got through with it. So these are the programs that they've identified for defunding. So it's no coincidence today that you see Obama's Deficit Commission talking about major changes in Social Security and Medicare in order to, quote-unquote, deal with the budget deficit. Really what they're doing is they're trying to, over time, defund these programs, destroy them, privatize them, so they can move those dollars into an arms race in space and other military technologies. So if you want to stop Star Wars, fight for social progress, fight for Social Security, fight for Medicare, for Medicaid, fight for unemployment insurance. That's how you end the military empire.
Denial implies the use of force.
Weapons from space to the ground.
The United States is going to become the space policeman.
Can the United States Air Force do this mission without weapons?
Winterville 38, Addison.
Aftec arms open. Time to
have no open job. This until 1727.
We are so dominant in space that I pity a country that would come up against us.
China carried out its first anti-satellite weapons test.
If aimed at commercial satellites, and such an attack could bring U.S. business and industry to a halt.
Space is the backbone of our national security.
There is no substitute, and there is no alternative to military dominance in space.
We have to move on to control space in order to protect commercial interests and investment.
Big profits.
This is our space tracking surveillance system.
Billions of dollars on research.
This is a cool business that we are in.
We, 5% of the world's population in the United States, are going to deny other countries access to space. I mean, absolutely provocative.
Pentagon officials say it's the first step toward eventually putting weapons into space.
An Earth surrounded by an outer layer of weapons.
Heavy tungsten metal rods from satellites onto the Earth.
Would it really be that big a step if a projectile itself were also launched from space? There's no practical difference. And I'd venture to say that the person on the receiving end wouldn't see the distinction either.
That's a reality. And if we don't accept that, well, we're just whistling in the dark. And we're going to be victims of our own technology.
Weaponization of space has happened a long time ago. And it's foolish to think that somehow we can stuff this genie into a bottle.
Well, now it's time to talk a bit about our voice, even if it is swamped by the American corporate media. Tell us about the film Pax Americana.
Well, it's a wonderful new film, Pax Americana and the Weaponization of Space, made by a French-Canadian filmmaker. It's already won an award out in the Vancouver area at a...
At the Whistler Film Fest.
That's right. It won Best Documentary there. And if you go to the Internet and just Google Pax Americana, you'll come to the website for the film, for the documentary, and there's a trailer on there, and you can watch a little bit of it, and you can order it from various Internet places where you can order videos. It's a great film, and it really tells the story of what's going on. The filmmaker got tremendous access into the bowels of the aerospace industry, into the Air Force laboratories and Air Force Academy, where the young space warriors are being trained. And in addition, he interviewed several people from our global network and other critics. So it's a really tremendous film, and really highly recommend it to people.
Be good for a peace party. You get a bunch of people over and just throw that in the DVD player and let people talk about it afterwards. You might actually move a few more minds at a time. And I wanted to ask you, too, about local action, what's going on in Maine, and what about this campaign, Bring Our War Dollars Home?
Well, in Maine, we've been trying to connect the dots. We've been meeting for, I'd say the last 4 or 5 years on a statewide basis, continually working hard to have the public begin to see the connections between war spending and the collapse of our economy. And we've created a statewide coalition called Bring Our War Dollars Home, and virtually every peace group in the state is now part of that. So we have regular meetings. This past Saturday, we had one with 16 people from all over the state in attendance, planning our program for the next year. So it's not really an organization, but it's a campaign. It's a network that we've built in Maine. We're not trying to duplicate or anything else what other people are doing. We're trying to really augment what people are doing. And all the groups in the state have really begun to integrate this whole idea of Bring Our War Dollars Home into the consciousness, into their work, and expanding the consciousness of the people. And in the last vote last summer on the war supplemental for the Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan wars, our two main congresspersons for the first time both voted against the war supplemental, even though it still passed. Obama pushed it through with the support of many Democrats. Our two members of Congress from Maine in the House both voted no because of this work of this campaign. So we're continuing on. But the real essence of this campaign is to not really focus so much on our two representatives or our two senators. We're focusing on the local politicians, because it's our analysis that with the devolution of the federal government, as the Republicans will continue that now that they're in charge of the House of Representatives, and Obama has basically capitulated to the Republican Party in Washington, in the state of Maine, our governor is now a Republican teabagger. The Republicans have just taken over our state legislature for the first time in 50 years. We're going to see the continued devolution of social progress, the continued cutbacks in social spending. And so that means that local people are going to be going to their local town governments, to their state governments, begging, crying for help, and they're going to be told no. And so the public is beginning to become more open to seeing this connection between war spending, because when we're spending, again, $8 billion a month in Afghanistan, people begin to say, well, geez, that money would go a long way back here at home, dealing with all of our problems that we have in education and, plowing snow and a lot of other things in our state. So we've gone to town meetings, we've gone to school boards, we've gone to the state legislature, and we're asking these politicians to take a stand on this question of war spending, Bring Our War Dollars Home. And we're seeing a good response from these politicians. And so what's happening is they're beginning to put pressure on our members of Congress. They're beginning to put pressure on Washington, not us, so to speak, but they are. And that's a whole nother dynamic when that begins to happen. And so we believe that that's the organizing strategy for this coming period, is to focus on the local politicians, because the politicians in Washington generally are under lockdown of the corporations. So focus on the local politicians, get them to begin to make the links, get them to begin to call for cutbacks in military spending, get them to call for an end to war spending, bring our war dollars home. And as that happens, we think there's a greater chance that we'll begin to see more action coming out of Washington. And so we've set up a website here in Maine called bringourwardollarshome.org, all spelled out, bringourwardollarshome.org. And that's now moved into Massachusetts. Recently, Northampton and Amherst, Massachusetts, city councils have passed resolutions calling on Bring Our War Dollars Home. It's spreading around the country. Code Pink has picked it up as a major campaign nationally. And so this whole idea is beginning to spread around the country as well. There's an old saying that Mainers love to use. It is, as Maine goes, so goes the nation. So, you know, maybe this is the case here, too.
We can hope so. Well, Bruce Gagnon, as we wrap up, I'd like to try and dream a little for ourselves and for our listeners. And it's difficult because you and I have grown up in this fear of nuclear annihilation and now allegedly terrorism, and the arms trade is flourishing worldwide. Weapons research funds are leaking into universities all over the place. We don't know how that affects students, and military bases support towns and even whole states. But suppose we can. Talk to me about the world we want, the human civilization built on peace. What would it look like?
Well, Alex, it's a good question. It's a fundamental question. You know, for me, it's all about a very simple question for me, is what is the role of a human being? What's the most important thing I can do with my life? Is it to have a nice car, to have the kind of job that my mother could brag about, you know, because I have a fancy title on my business card? Is it to have the best house on the block? Or is it to ensure the survival of the future generations? Not only the future generations of our relatives, our people, but also our animal relatives and our plant relatives on this planet. What the native people always remind us about is how we're all connected to one another. The water, the air, the plants, the animals, the things that crawl, the things that swim, the things that fly. So for me, that's what my life is about, is ensuring the survival of the future generations. So if we're going to have peace, if we're going to have a chance, if we're going to have a chance to live in harmony with our Mother Earth, then we have to really be engaged as a people, working together in this country and all over the world for this greater good that is greater than money, that is greater than quote-unquote success and privilege and greed. And I think people understand that, and I think people want that too. But we've all been taught to go along and get along, and I think we have to reject that, what I call the success mythology, the treadmill, the rat race, the dog-eat-dog business model culture, the warrior culture. And I think we have to say that out loud, say that in very uncomfortable places at times for us, at the dinner table with our relatives on a holiday, or where we work, or in class in school. We have to speak up, and we have to defend the Mother Earth and defend life and defend the future. And then when we do that, we begin to create a movement, and we become part of something larger. And that then gives us the chance to change something. But it all starts with the first step of courage in our heart, something the Wizard of Oz reminded us. And again, we have to decolonize our minds. We have to take them back from the corporations that have brainwashed us with consumerism and materialism.
I'm looking for a world with cooperation, with humility about the humans' place in this great scheme of things. I'm glad you brought up the animals and the plants and the waters and all of that, because we're really a tiny part of that instead of the masters of the universe, much less the masters of space. So And let's get back to maybe what the alleged holiday season is about. I'm looking for a world that's built on love. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, dreaming of peace, with longtime Maine activist Bruce Gagnon. Find out more at www.spaceforpeace.org. And I've got a lot more links for you in this week's show blog at ecoshock.info. Whether you are religious or not, we wish you the oldest and greatest blessing, peace on earth, and goodwill towards men, women, children, and all the innocent species of this amazing planet. Thank you so much, Bruce Gagnon.
Thank you, Alex. That's one of the best interviews I've ever done. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
This is Radio EcoShock.
The downside, of course, is you end up effectively imprisoning with no legal process whatsoever hundreds, in this case thousands, of entirely innocent, entirely peaceful people.
As student fees go up, as businesses go down, as welfare is cut off and pensions are cut down, people all over the world are calling for an end to wasteful military spending. On 17th November 2010, Stuart Parkinson, Executive Director of Scientists for Global Responsibility, addressed the Sheffield CND Annual General Meeting on Arms Conversion for a Low-Carbon Economy. Here is a small sample taken from the hour-long presentation.
So, arms conversion for a sustainable society. What I'm going to talk about tonight, I'm going to briefly go into the way in which the debate over security issues and defence issues and military issues are starting to change at a national and international level, and then talk about the UK military-industrial sector, how there are shifts in that sector and how these security strategies might create more of a shift in those areas. Then look at the environmental sectors, low-carbon sectors, which are growing very rapidly. Look at the potential for conversion from the military-industrial sectors to the more sustainable sectors, and then talk a little bit about some of the issues related directly to Sheffield. Then, more recently, there's been a more radical argument based on a concept called sustainable security, which is, rather than focusing on the use of military force and use of military equipment, is more focused on tackling the root causes of security. And in a report that was published a few years ago by a think tank called the Oxford Research Group, they argued that there are four main routes of security leading to insecurity in various parts of the world. Climate change, basically that's through issues like the changing climate and affecting things like water resources, so increasing drought, reducing the amount of water and therefore leading to conflict, or the problems associated with crop yields falling in a warming world and how that impacts on food security and can lead to conflict, and various other factors related to climate change. And you've got issues like competition over resources. That could be non-renewable resources like oil or mineral wealth, but also issues like renewable resources, water, forestry, fisheries, which, as we over-deplete our resources, use them faster than they're replenishing, therefore that can lead to conflict. The third issue was about, this is basically about poverty, global injustice, inequality caused by the way the economic system works, and the way that that can feed malcontent and lead to a source of conflict. And global militarism, the way in which huge military spending across the world currently spends about $1.5 trillion every year, and a big part of that is the international arms trade and how that can fuel armed conflict. So what this idea was of sustainable security was about looking at these at the root causes and trying to intervene and change the way our economy and society works so that we make a contribution to lessening these threats rather than having a big military that tries to protect us against the insecurity that may arise because of these problems. There are some broad aspects around the way that the UK sees itself as a global military power. The UK's military budget is one of the world's largest. It's number four below the USA, China and France. It's increased by more than a quarter over the last 10 years or so. We're home to the world's largest arms company, BAE Systems. That's recently overtaken all the big American arms companies like Lockheed Martin and Boeing. So now BAE Systems, through various mergers and acquisitions, has now become the world's largest. We're a major arms exporter. And it's interesting when you compare UK spending to other countries seen as competitors or potential adversaries. Our spending per person is twice that of Russia, 12 times that of China. Our spending is much, much larger. And this at a time when the UK is more secure, and even government recognises this, the UK is more secure from conventional military attack than at any time in its history. And yet we still have this huge military spend. The areas where there has been major shifts from military to civilian industry, as I kind of alluded to earlier, has been at, when you look at the economy as a whole, where you have, at the end of the World Wars, when you have closures of military bases, and the most recent relevant example is the end of the Cold War, where you have a shift in the broader economy so that the military industry closes down but new jobs are created in alternative civilian sectors. And it's interesting that in the 10 years from the mid-80s to the mid-90s, the military industrial sector in the UK lost over 200,000 jobs, and they were replaced in other parts of the economy, and that is about the size of the military industry that we have today. So the potential for that shift to happen.
That was Stuart Parkinson, Executive Director of Scientists for Global Responsibility, the Sheffield UK Committee for Nuclear Disarmament, November 17th, courtesy of Sheffield Indie Media. Find a link to the full speech in the Radio EcoShock blog for this program. We are out of time. I am Alex Smith, wishing you peace in our times and goodwill towards all. Thank you for listening.
Now I've been happy lately, thinking about the good things to come, and I believe it could be something good has begun. Oh, I've been smiling lately, dreaming about the world at one, and I believe it could be someday it's going to come. 'Cause out on the edge of darkness, there rides a peace train. This country, come take me home again. Now I've been smiling lately, thinking about the good things to come, and I believe it could be something good has begun. For oh, peace train sounding louder,
ride on the peace train. Ooh, ooh.
Come on the peace train, get peace train.
Everyone jump
up
on the peace train.
Ooh, 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 ooh. Come on, the peace train. Get your bags together. Go bring your good friends too. Cause it's getting nearer. It soon will be with you. Come and join the living. It's not so far from you. And it's getting nearer. Soon it will all be true. Oh, peace train sounding louder.
Ride on the peace train.
Ooh, ooh. Come on, the peace train. Peace train. Now I've been crying lately, thinking about the world as it is. Why must we go on hating? Why can't we live in bliss? 'Cause out on the edge of darkness, there rides a peace train. Oh, peace train, take this country. Come take me home again. Oh, peace train sounding louder.
Ride on the peace train.
Come on, the peace train. This peace train, the holy rolling.
Everyone jump up on the peace train. Ooh,
ooh, ooh, ooh.
Come on, come on, come on.
Come on, peace train. Hey, yes, it's the peace train.